You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
Everyone, very excited about today's episode. We're getting the opportunity to speak with Jackie Cummings Koski. The reason this episode, I think, is going to hold so much value for our audience is Jackie, single mom, breadwinner for her family, raising her daughter, never made more than six figures. Growing up in poverty in the Deep South, she stated, "I had an insatiable desire to do better with my own personal finances and to do better for my family." To see where she's come, I mean, Jackie is retiring from corporate America, had a 20-year stint in corporate America, built for herself and her family a six-figure HSA, which is the equivalent of a superpower, in my opinion, for reasons that we'll talk about today in some level of detail. I think this episode is going to be inspiring and bring so much value for our community. To help me with this, I have my co-host, Brandt, here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing quite well. And yeah, Jackie is famous in the FI world for her six-figure HSA. And while I think you and I expected that to be the podcast episode, her story is so fascinating that I just can't wait to dive into it. And I suspect we're going to spend the entire episode just talking about her background, where she's been, and more importantly, where she's going as she transitions to FI. So Jackie, with that, welcome to the podcast.
Hey guys, thanks so much for having me.
Well, Jackie, I wanted to start with, actually, we were talking just for a few minutes offline, and you brought up, and I think it's such a valid point, that when you see in the media a caricature of what the financial independence movement is about, often it seems to say that this is for people that make over six figures. This is just for these select individuals that have all of this wind at their back. And it fails to encompass that there are people from all walks of life and every stage of life that are pursuing this. And I'm just curious, like for you, when you see that representation, one, I guess actually for our audience to find, you know, kind of what do you see the media characterizing the people that are on this path? And then what's your perception of this having done this?
Well, I see a lot of what everyone else sees when the big media comes out with stories highlighting the FIRE community. It's the traditional white male tech engineer, and some of that is true. But from my perspective, there are so many diverse voices now in this community that should be heard to say there's no one way. There's a lot of things that I read that might even be considered a tenets of FIRE where I don't meet all that criteria. I mean, there's no doctrine or something that you have to sign to be a part of the FIRE community in order to support the whole idea of just reaching financial independence so that you are free to do what you want and find your happiness, whatever it looks like.
So if we go back to your story, your money story, I mean, this was not your path from birth.
Absolutely not. I grew up in the rural South and we're very poor. I was raised by a single dad with six kids, if you can imagine. He only had a sixth grade education. He worked at a factory, but he was raising six kids. And growing up, I really just did not understand how unique that was. I just saw that we lived paycheck to paycheck. We're in poverty. I remember we were on the free lunch program at school. So it was very, very tough growing up. And the one thing that stuck in my head that I really remember is that I didn't want to live like this when I got older. But my dad, he is like one of the most amazing people I have ever known to be able to pull off raising six kids. I mean, he must have been able to do things and stretch a dollar like no one would imagine. Right around the time I was a senior in high school, he got colon cancer. And he was just this really strong patriarch. And to see him to get sick and to see his health decline, it was really scary for me. But he ended up passing away right before I graduated from high school. So about 3 months before I graduated from high school. That had such an impact on me. From that point, I was just determined that I had to do it on my own. I wasn't going to have all the help that other people had. And I just went towards it. College was probably that first step for me in the right direction to getting out of poverty.
Yeah, Jackie, your dad certainly sounds like a hero. There's no question about that. I mean, raising six kids as a single dad. I mean, do you have any recollection of conversations that you had about money, or did he ever talk about that at all? Did you ever get any lessons from him overtly?
You know, all the lessons that I got from him was simply watching and seeing what he did. He never sat us down to talk about money. Everything was what I watched. For instance, he went to work every single day. I never, ever recall him not going to work or taking a sick day. He worked a second job for the entire time I can recall. I guess we'd call it a side hustle now. He worked for a construction company even when he got off work. And so that work ethic stuck with me. I remember him talking sometimes about paying for something on time, which is like an old-fashioned term for getting a loan versus just paying for it. And that stuck with me because I didn't have huge student loans. The way that I was taught to get through college was to work my butt off. I worked 50 plus hours a week, two jobs just to get through school. And so all these lessons were around me, but he never really sat us down to tell us directly, you know, say this, do that. It was all from what I watched him do.
You know, it's incredible how if you take that work ethic, that hard work that you were willing to lean in and put that extra time in, that you saw your father model this behavior and you took that with you. And the fact, I mean, what you just said about what you did in college, almost as an extreme example, I'm going to brute force this thing and I'm going to make this work, even if it looks like me going to school, paying for it, cash flowing it as I go, 50 plus hours a week. I don't know very many individuals that have done that, much less could do that. And I'm curious, like, if you think about that, is that the path? Would you do that again? Like, just play that out from your perspective now.
Yeah, now that I'm an adult and I see my daughter going through school, she's finished now, but watching her go through school, I do wish that I would have been able to spend more time on my academics in college, because I did still, even though I was working full time, I was still going to school full time as well. So I was juggling a lot and I didn't really get to participate in a lot of the academic experiences like joining clubs, spending the time that I knew I needed for certain classes. And my GPA certainly would have been a lot higher. I was pretty good academically. So I think if I would have concentrated a lot more on studying and keeping a high GPA, I probably would have been able to qualify for many more scholarships that would help me pay for my education versus just thinking about an hourly rate. So if I could do it over, I would just focus more on how can I get scholarships, assistantships, and funding for my education versus just working a near minimum wage job. So I do have a few regrets about that. But on the plus side, I came out of school with very little student loan debt that now that I look at it, that's probably helped me quite a bit as well, because I was able to put more money towards investing and saving versus toward paying off my student loans.
So Jackie, that's an interesting thought. The real hourly wage, I guess, if you will, of potentially going for scholarships. While you were brute forcing this, and clearly it worked, right? You said you left college with minimal student loan debt. Maybe, and we'll never know, right? Because it's a counterfactual, but like...
I love it when you say counterfactual.
Thank you, John. But, right, like...
I mean, had to go look it up separately.
But right, I mean, you can never prove that you would have done better with scholarships, but your thought is that maybe that might have been the more optimal play. And I'm curious, did you pass it on to your daughter? How did she approach college? And did you try to right that quote unquote wrong, if you will, with her?
I kind of did. And that's really funny that you mentioned that, because her first year out of high school, she went to a university about 2 hours away. She was there for about a year. And I remember after a year, she said, "Mom, I don't like just being a college student. I want to be more like an adult. I want to work too." So that was just the opposite of the situation that I had. And I'm like, "You're kidding." I said, "I wish I would have been able to just go to school and not have to work." So that I definitely passed that on to her. And so finally, she did come back to our city and decided on what she wanted to do, which is graphic design. And she ended up getting her degree from a community college that's in our area. And she is thrilled as can be and working for a great company. And it just worked out wonderfully. So not knowing it, I did pass on this tremendous work ethic to her. She wanted to work hard. She didn't just want to go to school. So in the long run and seeing how she's prospered, she did the exact right thing. And I was very proud to see that, what a hard worker she is, and that I passed that on to her.
Well, you said not knowing it. And the reason that stood out to me is that I'm watching the video that we have for this. And right behind you, there's a book that's written by you called Money Letters. And Money Letters was a book that you wrote to pass on your knowledge to your daughter when it comes to finances. And the way that you stated that to me was, based on your backstory, your background, your upbringing, that instilled in you an insatiable desire to change your economic picture. So I'm curious, what gets us from that insatiable desire to a book that we're handing to our daughter that inspires her to take this slightly different path?
I could not waste everything that I learned about personal finance and money management and financial independence. And I had this desire to make sure that I pass that on to my daughter. And when I was in college, my major was communications and I focused a lot on journalism. So I was always a writer and I loved to write. So my idea to get all this information to her, even later on in life, because honestly, she was 14 when I first started writing the book and I wanted to give it to her as her high school graduation gift. So this teenager was not really listening to me. So I figured writing it down was the ideal way to encapsulate this journey that I've been on and pass on all this great information and all this great knowledge that I wanted to pass on to her. So I started writing it and I just wanted it to be entertaining enough for her to even want to pick up. So I wrote it in a format of this, just these short, quick letters that was very to the point about finances and things that I knew would be important to her as she went through life. So that's what started me to write the book.
I want to talk about your financial journey, because if we were to, right before this, we were basically talking about this brute force tactic to get through school, coming out with no debt. Like, at what point were you actively going outside of your zone awareness to bring new knowledge in? And then what impact did that have on your financial direction?
I think a lot of it happened around the time that I got divorced. So I was married for about 11 years. And what I thought was going to be a couple journey to success and happiness and financial independence, after the divorce, that turned into single motherhood. And I had to do all that on my own. So that was probably one of my biggest epiphanies, that I really need to focus on these things. And during the divorce, it was just such an awakening for me. But when you get divorced, your retirement accounts are basically looked at and they're split down the middle. So when my husband and I, we were making about the same salary and had a very similar 401k match from our companies. So when we looked at the accounts, I had $20,000 in my 401k. I was thrilled about it. I thought I was doing great. My husband had $120,000. So he had over $100,000 more than I did in his retirement account. And I don't know how that happened, but I was just crushed that I did not know there was this disparity. I had no idea what he had and no idea that there was such a difference in how I was saving and investing and how he was saving and investing. So luckily, during the process of splitting up the assets, I was able to get a portion of that. And when it was all said and done, I think it was around $60,000 that went to me when we split up these assets. And we're talking 12, 13 years later, that $60,000, I invested it and I never put a penny in. I never took a penny out. And that account is now worth just under $200,000. So I'm thinking that's a win. And I'm so glad that, you know, a lot of times some of the things that we do wrong, they teach us bigger lessons than the things that we do right. And that was certainly one of them.
Yeah. And you wrote to us that you felt so uninformed about your finances. And that quote just really stuck out to me at that point in time. So, I mean, you guys were saving your 401ks. It seemed like things were going well, but was it just a lack of communication between you and your husband? Was it a case of, I mean, financial infidelity where he decided, that might be a bit of a stretch, but where he decided to put all the money in his 401k? Or talk me through how that occurs. As you look back on it with the benefit of hindsight, how did he have 120K in this 401k and you only had 20K?
Do some financial CSI for us here.
Yeah. As I look back, I don't think it was a conscious thing on his part that he was wanting to make sure more of the money went into his account at all. I was just not curious enough to ask and to want to put all this money in a pile together. We should have been talking. We should have been communicating. We should have been looking at everything holistically. Honestly, we did everything else, but it started from the net paycheck that came into the bank accounts, and that's what we managed together. I never really looked back at the retirement accounts. And, you know, shame on me. I mean, I certainly know better now. And I think what he may have done different is that I was just getting the company match, and I think he was doing a lot more than the company match. Now, I didn't have the opportunity to go back and look at what the investments were. And honestly, at the time of the divorce, it just wasn't the best time to ask.
Yeah. Lines of communication tend to break down around that point.
Yeah.
So you had this moment where you woke up and said, okay, I need to take ownership of this. How do I get on a path to financial literacy? And obviously, it was a multi-year path from the time when you divorced, you said your daughter was 9 and you started writing the book when she was 14. So there's a 5-year education path, I assume, that you undertook. I'd love to hear about it.
When I first got divorced, I had to ask that huge, important question, what do I do now as a single person? What do I love? What do I enjoy? And I discovered my interest in financial literacy, learning about investing and money management and things like that. That's just what interested me. So I ended up finding this investment club, a stock investment club. It's supported by a nonprofit organization called Better Investing, and they support individual investors and investment clubs. So the club that I attended, I didn't have to be a member. I could just observe what they did. It was pretty amazing. Now, the funny thing was that most of the members were older members, but they decided they wanted to do it themselves. And now that I look back, it seems a lot like the financial independence community because they're do-it-yourselfers. Now, back in the day, you didn't have necessarily index funds, or it was very expensive to invest. It was considered a rich person's thing to do. These people were doing it themselves. They were analyzing stocks, analyzing companies. And the nerd that I am, I just found that fascinating. And I love that it was crowdsourced and you've got the group knowledge. So I ended up joining that club and I learned so much, and it took away the fear of the stock market. It took away the fear of investing. And that was my very first step to opening my mind to the whole world of investing. And this is how you grow your money and you get to wealth. So once I started being a part of this investment club, I think that's what kind of led me to wanting to write this book. And once the book was out, Money Letters to My Daughter, I started getting people that were interested in having me come in and speak, like at high schools and colleges. And of course, I went back to my own community to talk about the financial literacy lessons that I wrote in this book. This was very interesting to me as well, that I not only could share this with my daughter, but I could share it with so many other people. So for many years, for the past 10 years or so, that's what I've been doing, is speaking, workshops, classes all around financial literacy and financial education, and specifically focusing on some underserved populations that I know are not getting this message from anywhere else. So that has kind of led me to want to do a lot more in the financial literacy, financial education space, because to me, that is the first step to even thinking financial independence is possible.
So Jackie, I just want to take a step back real quick and just put you in that moment again. You just got this divorce. You realize I need to move forward. And you found this investment club. But I think a lot of us, I know myself, there's that imposter syndrome. I would be so nervous to walk into that investment club that very first time. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on how you took that step, because I think that's what's applicable for a lot of people is there are things that we want to pursue in life, but we're nervous, we're scared. There's that imposter syndrome that sinks in, right? But the beautiful thing by hearing people's stories like yours is you did this. You actually got up off that couch and join this investment club when that might have been scary for you. I'd love to hear just that moment of how you decided to do that.
Okay, that's an interesting question. My take on that is it started with chatting with someone that I knew from work. She was actually based in Boston, and we were talking about investing in stocks. And she mentioned this organization, and she's like, well, I know there's a club in Boston, but I'm sure there's one near you as well. So I started Googling. What made it a little bit easier for me was the fact that you didn't have to join to attend meetings and observe, and they encouraged that. So I like that. And I like the fact that they were nonprofit, because there's just so many things out there where, you know, they're just trying to make money off of you. And I wanted to make sure it was not that. So after attending, I would say 3 or 4 meetings, the people were very friendly. They would chat with me afterwards. I think I even went to lunch with them after a meeting. So I think it did make a difference, the community around this investment club. And I finally decided I was ready to join. And I never looked back, but I so learned a great deal from all of these brilliant minds. I mean, these guys are bigger nerds than me in terms of analyzing companies, analyzing stocks. And I've, you know, they say you're the average of the 5 people you spend the most time with. Well, I was spending a lot of time with them. We met once a month, but I could just feel my brain growing when I was around them. And they were interested in the same thing that I was. So they embraced me. They taught me so much. And now for the new people that are interested in investing in individual companies and they're looking at this organization, I'm holding out a hand to them to say, come on, let me teach you, and embracing them for the people that's interested. And honestly, the vast majority of people probably should stick with just index funds. But there are some people, including myself, that really love investing in individual companies and enjoy analyzing and doing the work that's needed to learn about these companies. I enjoy being an owner of individual stocks.
That's awesome. So let me ask you a question, because you mentioned that you felt this calling to serve underserved populations, and that drew you to high schools and working with students. And I'd like to hear you reflect on the power of the $2 bill.
Okay. So that's one of the fun parts. Working with high school and college students, they are probably the toughest group you will ever work with. But I love it, because when I see the light bulb come on, it's amazing. So I had to think about, and thinking, keeping my own daughter in mind, I had to think about what is going to get their attention. And I figured I'd pay them. So that's where the $2 bills came from. But I tell them the story of why the $2 bills are important to me. When I was in high school, you know, growing up in poverty, I would hold on to $2 bills. When I started working in high school, working in college, and throughout my life, I kept getting these $2 bills and saving them because I thought they were special. I mean, they're really not. They're only worth $2 face value. When I started these financial literacy classes, I think I had gotten up to about $3,200 worth of $2 bills.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do with them. And I knew that I just couldn't go to the store and spend them. So I thought, you know, as I'm doing these classes, I'm going to give away $2 bills for good questions, good answers, and to make sure these students are engaged. And the first time I did that, it solidified, this is exactly what I need to be doing. So now I'm kind of known as the $2 bill lady, and the kids love having me come in. The teachers love having me come in because of this.
I love the idea. And I'm curious, when you're talking with a group of students, with what you're saying is one of the hardest groups to reach, to get their attention, to maintain their attention, but you're framing it as, I'm talking to my daughter, what I want my daughter to know. You have 30 minutes. You have 30 minutes to work with these students. What are you imparting in that period of time for the highest level of impact?
Yeah. And you know what? I've been put in positions where all I had was 30 minutes. We're talking high school, where when the bell rings, it's over. So given a small window of time, there's two or three things that I do want to hit on. My first thing is always save something. So the $2 bill, I only save $2, maybe once a month, but it created the habit. So even if you're living in poverty, even if you have nothing, you can probably find a way to save a little something, even if it's 50 cents. Just create the habit, because as you make more, you will save more. And then for that age group, this question comes up all the time and I can't ignore it. They ask about credit. So I talk to them about, you know, what is a credit score and what's the formula that goes into a credit score? And those kids, they are such quick learners. By the time I'm done mentioning like something like Credit Karma, they've already gone to Credit Karma on their app and pulled up their credit score. These are like high school kids or college kids, and they have a credit score. So between the saving and the credit, probably the last thing I love to mention is showing them the value of compound growth. So the number that I use, if you save just $50 a week for 40 years, that $50 will grow to $1 million if you have it invested in the stock market. So everyone in this room can be a millionaire.
Yeah, that is high impact. I see that. Those are three pillars. And if you have 30 minutes, wow, if you can get those three lessons across. In fact, Brad, I think that for you, that lightning bolt, that spark for you was the compound interest calculation.
Yeah, Jackie, I can certainly relate to this. As when I was a 19-year-old kid, someone sat me down in front of a compound interest calculator. That 5 minutes or 10 minutes changed my entire life. Because yeah, it's remarkable to see, wow, I only have to save that little to be a millionaire or a multimillionaire. It's remarkable. And really, how many people after 40 years are millionaires at all? I mean, a tiny, tiny, tiny little fraction. And you're telling me it only takes $50 a week? I mean, if I was sitting in that class, my eyes and my brain would explode probably. I mean, that's so cool.
Yeah. And on top of that, I've seen a lot in the Choose FI Facebook group where people will ask, hey, what's a great gift for my high school or college kid? I put together this little letter that basically shows the compound growth of $50 a month. And I will tell them the same thing. $50 a week will get you to a millionaire over 40 years. I give them a crisp new $50 bill and I say, here's the first $50 to get you started. And they all love that. Most of them won't even spend it, but that's just a special message that will probably resonate with them and stick with them much longer than any other gift you could give them.
Would you be willing to give us a copy of that letter to share with our newsletter?
Yeah, I absolutely will.
Awesome. Okay, now I want to talk, because you in 20 years reached financial independence. Within a 20-year period of time, 20-year stint in corporate America, reached financial independence. I want to talk about, just in passing, the six-figure HSA. And I want to say this, like, how the HSA, health savings account, how did you stumble on this? And how has this affected your trajectory with regards to financial independence?
Okay, so it was very unlikely that this would be the thing that kind of pushed me over the top to financial independence. The way that I first came across it, working for corporate America, our company first introduced it in 2008. And basically, it's a high deductible plan that, you know, is required to be able to get a health savings account. So it's only qualified plans. And for me and my daughter, we were pretty healthy. The only time we would go to the doctor is maybe twice a year for our wellness visits, maybe a little bit, maybe a couple different medications or something like that. But it was so minimal. And as you guys know, the cost of insurance has been just out of control. So when I had the opportunity to like slash my health insurance premiums to almost a quarter of what I had been paying, I was all about it. I dug into the details because I wanted to make sure I understood what I was getting into. And back then, again, this was around 2008, there wasn't a lot of information. So I really had to dig and dig and dig. And the three things that stuck out to me that really convinced me was, one, the fact that the money could roll over from year to year. And then two, the fact that I could invest the funds and just let it grow. And at the time, I didn't call it a third retirement account, but in my mind, I was kind of thinking that. So knowing that I hardly ever went to the doctor, that I could max out this account, I was in a position to do so at the time. Now, certainly if there was any kind of big catastrophic issues that we had, maybe I would have used it. But the way that it worked out year after year after year, my daughter and I are still just going for regular wellness visits. We're very lucky to be healthy and to not have a lot of out-of-pocket costs to where we can simply cash flow and pay for all of our medical expenses out of pocket and use the money to invest and to have it grow. And so when people ask me, how did you get that much in your account? It's really just math. Like we always say, it's really just math. Anyone else that would have been able to max out the family contributions to the health savings account and invest it for 11 years, they would pretty much have $120,000 too. Since then, I have realized that there are so many more phenomenal benefits to having this account. And of course, after reading that like amazing post by Mad Scientist about the health savings account, that is really what supercharged me and helped me realize how valuable this was on my journey to FI and helping me reach financial independence and retiring early and having that pot of money designated just for my healthcare.
So I did not have access to an HSA for several years. And so I have like a baby HSA right now. It has less than $20,000 in it. And so I'm just curious, when you have an individual, when you have over six figures, $120,000, at some point you're going to have $200,000 in this HSA. Like, how does that change everything? I mean, do you have like a mental partition that you use? Like, oh, here's what I'll use this for. This is what it's going to do. Like, what does it look like for you?
Well, here's the big thing. So I definitely consider me and my daughter being very lucky to have had good health for this long period of time. But the one thing I know for sure is that my healthcare expenses are going to be a lot more in the future than they have been in the past. And so I'm continuing to let it grow until I feel like I need it. What you can use the health savings account funds for, it's a very exhaustive list. It's publication number 502 from the IRS. But there's so many things you can use it for, not just medical. You can use it for dental out-of-pocket expenses. You can use it for vision out-of-pocket expenses. So between all of those things, I feel like it's just going to give me a break from having to pull from my other accounts, because anything that's medical, I got that covered. And it just gives me peace of mind. There's the uncertainty with health insurance and the cost of healthcare. Even if you have insurance, the out-of-pocket expenses can be crazy out of control too. So it definitely put me in a better mental space dealing with healthcare, because everyone knows that the healthcare system in America is quite challenging, and it seems like it's gotten even worse. So having that piece kind of taken care of with sort of a backstop with my health savings account, it really helps me feel better about making this leap from depending on corporate America for insurance and now doing it on my own.
Yeah, I think quite challenging might be the nicest way I've heard anybody put that.
Are you doing quite well, Brad?
Yes, I'm doing quite well. The U.S. healthcare system is quite challenging. I agree. And so in your mind's eye, you do consider the HSA a medical vehicle. Because I think mentally how people can approach it might be somewhat different. Like, you could just look at it as, okay, I'm never touching this until 65, when I believe you can start pulling it out penalty free. And I'd love to hear your clarification on that.
Yeah.
But you do consider it, okay, this is earmarked for medical expenses.
I think of it as being a very flexible account. So yes, I can use it for my healthcare expenses if I need to now. And yes, I can use it in retirement if I don't need it. And that's the beauty of it. It's very flexible. Now, the part that you're talking about, once you turn 65, you can take the money out of your health savings account and there's no penalty. Normally, if you take it out before age 65 and it's not for a qualified medical expense, you're going to pay a 20% penalty. And that's a bigger penalty than what you'd have to pay for early withdrawal of an IRA or a 401k. But once you turn 65, you don't have to pay that 20% penalty. You can spend it on whatever you want, but you do have to pay taxes on it. So it's not completely tax-free. You could think of it sort of like a traditional IRA. You'd be paying taxes on it, but you would not have to pay the penalty.
But along the way, if you're tracking those eligible medical receipts, all those little dental visits, the pregnancy, the hip replacement, the ophthalmic care, all those receipts, and you track them up over time because you're cash flowing those, there's a good chance that when you need it, you have over your lifetime, you have over $100,000 of eligible medical receipts that you can draw tax penalty free, you know, either before or after, and you're just letting compounding do its thing in the meantime. I mean, it's a truly incredible vehicle.
Yeah. And the way I think of it, as far as my contributions, so I could contribute $6,000 in a year, and then I decide to just spend it down every single year on medical expenses. But I think of it 10 years in the future. So instead of being worth $6,000, it's now worth over $12,000. So when I think of how it multiplies just by waiting a little bit, that kind of motivates me to continue investing it, because now I have a whole lot more than I would have had if I would have spent it down immediately. And you mentioned holding on to receipts. So some people kind of get hung up on that. If you don't want to use that strategy, then don't. But there are some easy ways to do that. I am so low tech, it's ridiculous. So basically with my receipts, I will just take a picture of it on my iPhone, and I'll just email it to myself, put the amount, the date, and the subject line, and I have a folder for it. And that's it. It's all in the cloud. I don't spend a lot of time on it. And for me and my daughter, since we are such low consumers of healthcare, I really don't have a lot of receipts at this point. So when I read that Mad Scientist article about saving receipts and then cashing them out at any time, I started doing that, but I didn't really even do it before. But for people that do have significant expenses, you're right, that can add up very quickly. And if you hold on to those receipts, just save them digitally, you can go back and get them at any time. And it's such an ideal strategy to use when you're retiring early, because those first couple of years that you're retiring, you may want to keep your income as low as possible. And to be able to pull out money and not have it considered taxable income could be a huge plus to have at that moment.
So this is actually very interesting. And this probably goes more to the personality than what's the absolute right way to do it. Like Brad's method is probably unreplicable. I feel like mine has been like carefully thought out. It's a moderate balance, but it's probably closer to what he's doing just because he's anchored me to this more extreme accountant method. But I have a Google Drive. I have a Google Sheet. Inside that Google Sheet, I have the line item for my wife, you know, and then what the expense was, and then a link to the digital receipt. So it's like you, I've taken a picture of that receipt. It's been uploaded to a Google Drive. And then that new Google Drive picture is now hyperlinked on this Google Sheet. That's what I do. And that's because it's a lot easier to, it's easy enough to say, hey, they're there. But then when you want to reliably draw out that income and then say, hey, here's the proof of why I was able to bring this out, I want to then be able to have a way of going back with minimal work to, I feel like Brad would actually approve of my method on this. I'm curious.
Sounds impressive.
If I could focus a little bit more on what is your confidence level and how you're actually doing this, you take the picture, you email it to yourself with the what it was and what the dollar amount is. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's pretty much what I do. And my system probably sucks, but I keep them all in an HSA folder, a digital folder in my email. And if I ever need to go back, I can see the amount very quickly and I can see the date of it very quickly. So I may want to go hit the bigger receipts first or something like that. So it's very simplistic. And you're right, it's kind of personality. I've heard people do all kinds of different ways, but I guess the bottom line is it could be a very simplistic process, and I wouldn't get hung up on holding onto receipts because there's so much of a payoff if you decide to do that. I mean, imagining being able to pull out $5,000 because you have those expenses saved, it's kind of a nice tool to have.
Yeah, that's incredible. And just one last question, if you don't mind, since you're the expert and I've been dying to ask someone this. So let's say you get the bill from the doctor and I call up and I pay with my credit card and they give me a confirmation number. They always ask, do you want me to mail you the receipt? The question to you is that bill from the doctor sufficient to show that I paid? Like, if I just write out the confirmation number, is the bill sufficient in and of itself? Like, do I need to show a credit card statement? What do I have to show? Or is it just simply always get that receipt showing payment from the doctor?
Well, the IRS isn't super clear on the tracking of the HSA expense. So they just basically say something like, you need to have a receipt for the service that was performed with a date and that shows that you paid. So I would definitely get a receipt that shows that it has been paid. So when you're on the phone and they give you a confirmation number, I would want a copy of the receipt. These days, most providers will do things digitally. When I want to pay a bill, I go online and I pay the bill online and I immediately have a receipt electronically. So it saves me a step. But if you happen to do it over the phone, I would go ahead and get a receipt because you could use your credit card, but the credit card really doesn't have a lot of detail. And even the receipt is not going to have a lot of detail because remember, you've got HIPAA law. So you don't want to have too much detail on there to begin with. So you want to show that you were the patient, that it has the date on there and that it was paid. And that's sufficient.
Yeah.
And there's not much more specific guidance from the IRS on what other types of proof they would want.
And I have two other thoughts just to add to that. So one is that many times when you have an employer, you have an employer HSA set up. You got to keep in mind, even though that HSA may have a place for you to submit receipts, you may not be with this one HSA for the rest of your life. So if you're thinking, oh, I've uploaded my receipts to my HSA company, they're not going to give you those back. You're never going to get them back when you leave. And so you need to be cognizant of that, which is why you should have your own system for actually managing this. And then the other thing that's actually useful, Brad, and this goes to your family, and this is what I found is, payment aside, when you log on to your insurance, so I have United Healthcare, you can log into my UHC, you'll have your own variant, and you can actually see every claim that's been billed against your insurance. This is a good way to partition out. Perfect example, my wife is pregnant. We had a billing process for paying them this payment plan, but I couldn't match that up to what bills and services were actually being charged for. So like there's a difference between how you pay and what you're actually being billed for. When it comes to what you're gonna get reimbursed on for your records, it's really helpful to have itemized receipts. Your insurance company has a list of not everything. Keep in mind that you're not limited to just what is billed to your insurance, but they have an itemized list of the vast majority. So that could be a good place for you to do any forensics if you're trying to clean up past years to find out all of your itemized bills. But then keep in mind that may not include prescriptions that you paid for totally out of pocket or went through a discount card. You're still eligible for that. Ophthalmic care, dental care. There are things that won't show up in there, but you can track all of this. And going to that publication that you referenced, it's a really good idea to know that there's so much that's covered under the umbrella of HSA.
Yeah, Brett taught me something last year that I didn't know because it never really applied to me. But you mentioned that you were on an HSA eligible plan for the first time, but it was toward the end of the year, like in November or something, and you were able to take advantage of something called the last month rule. So of course I had to dig into that because I had never really heard of it because I didn't need to use it. But basically that rule could be helpful for other people. If you're changing jobs or whatever circumstances change where in the middle of the year, you become eligible for an HSA, typically you would have to prorate your contributions month by month. But as long as you are on an HSA eligible plan by December 1st of any given year, you can make the maximum contribution for that year. And the only caveat to that is that you do have to remain on a qualified plan for the next 12 months. So it would be December 31st of the following month. But as long as you meet that requirement, that's awesome that if you started this plan in November, that you can max it out for the entire year and play a little catch up.
Nice.
Yeah. Wow. That's super cool. I'm glad I taught you something on HSAs. I didn't see that one coming. So yeah, that was neat. I was able, Jonathan and my family were each able to max out our HSAs for 2018 just by knowing that one little rule. And it's amazing how that's how life works, right? It's these little pieces of information. And now we've passed that along to all the listeners of Choose the Five, right? So
now, how did you find out about that?
I was doing some research on it and I was dealing with our insurance agent and just kind of talking about this. And I found this rule and I passed it along to her and said, is there any way you could look into this for me? Because I figured it would just be prorated. I figured it would just be 1/12, I think, of the $6,900 limit, which is what it was for 2018. if memory serves. So I was like, all right, is it really worth it to put in $500? It seemed a bit of a hassle. But once I found that rule and corroborated that it was factual, it was a no-brainer to max that thing out.
And to clarify, the incentive there, that actually was an extra incentive to start the policy in December as opposed to November. Is that accurate?
Yeah. In our particular case, this very limited case. Yeah, Jonathan, you're absolutely right.
The details sometimes matter. Details. Yeah. All right. Cool. Well, I tell you what, Jackie, we would love to have you back on an upcoming Friday roundup dedicated to building that six-figure HSA and specifically taking listener questions, kind of make it an FAQ episode for HSAs. We can create a submission. So if people have questions they want us to tackle on the show, they can do those ahead of time. Would you like to join us for an episode in the future to target that?
Oh, guys, I would love to. I'm there.
Jackie, this information with regards to HSA, I know how powerful this is. And it's one of those, I mean, truly, this is one of those wealth snowball plays that if you can get this, if you can front load this, if you can lean into it early on, you benefit literally for the rest of your life. And it's really incredible. Now, I think one other place that Brad and I want to kind of land with this episode is actually talk about the FIRE letter. You've reached financial independence and it came to the point where you had to tell your employer that you're parting ways. You're going on to the next chapter. And I love the way you did it. Tell us a little bit more, yeah, about the FIRE letter.
You know, the spark for that was, honestly, I would not have made it to financial independence were it not for the company that I was working for, because it allowed me to max out my 401k with a generous company match, dirt cheap insurance, and I had a great manager. So I wanted my departure to be a positive thing. I wanted them to know that I was very happy with the company. It had nothing to do with them. So it was important for me to write a letter that really represented how I felt in leaving the company and what my endeavors were going forward. I wanted to do it with dignity. So I'm hoping that it was a very nice letter. My boss, when he received it, he really appreciated it. I gave them a huge amount of notice. I gave him a soft notice in the summer. And then I told him that I would give him a firm letter with a firm date at least 60 days prior. And he appreciated that. I think it's really important to go out with dignity and go out in a very positive way where they appreciate your contribution and it's a very friendly separation. The content of it was just thanking them for supporting me as an employee, as a mom, the leadership that I had gotten, and just to uplift everyone. And one of my goals of what I put in the letter also was to uplift as many people as I could on the way out. And just to leave it on a very positive note.
Yeah, and this is a beautiful letter. I mean, truly beautiful. First, I mean, you gave them 2.5 months of notice. I mean, that's really, really sweet. But here you're saying, I've certainly spent many months imagining such a divergence from the norm and ultimately came to this conclusion. I could follow a traditional path or blaze my own. I chose the latter. I mean, that is chill-inducing. And you go on to say, my next step. Well, change is always scary, and this is no exception. I have aspirations of being at the forefront of educating and inspiring people to better understand their finances and raising America's financial IQ. I know, big dreams, but it's the culmination of many years of following my passion for financial literacy. That is absolutely beautiful. And I'd love to know, what was your manager's response when they got this letter?
Well, the way that I delivered it to them, because we're in this financial independence community where the financial impact on your life is profound. That is the key to get you on your path of happiness. It's a big deal because finances keep a lot of people up at night. And now that we have found a way to remove that obstacle, it's profound. So the way that I did the letter, first of all, I printed it out on high quality resume paper because this was special. I wanted to make it special. And I put it in this flat envelope and I'm literally carrying it to his office, holding it with both hands like I was the ring bearer in a wedding or something. And I leave it to him and I say, this is the letter. And he goes, what letter? And he says, oh, that's the letter. So I left it with him because I did want him to read it in private. And I didn't want to email it to him. I thought about that, but I wanted it printed out and I wanted to give it to him in person. And about 30 minutes later, he came to my desk and he says, "That was the nicest letter I ever read." So that was what I would dream of him saying, that he would appreciate that. And he's been so supportive the entire time I've had him as a boss, and even from the VP and the CEO up, I've been very, very lucky. So there would be no reason for me not to make this separation as positive and as uplifting as possible for everyone involved. I have sort of a word template where somebody, because when I was writing that letter, I was trying to look for a template. And of course, there was nothing because there's no fire letters. but I have a Word version where I just have insert here, your company name and all that. So I can send that to you if someone wants a copy of the letter just to start it sort of as a skeleton for them, and they can fill it out to customize for their. Hopefully we'll have a lot more people saying that I turned in my fire letter today.
That's going to be a thing. That is so cool. Yes. Can we put that in the vault?
Oh, absolutely. I think you have the PDF version where that's the actual letter. Yeah. I've just redacted it, but I do have a Word version where someone can take that. It's in Word and they can start typing in, you know, whatever changes they
Jackie,
want.
Jackie, you are on fire. All right. Well, on those shows, that would be the end of the episode. But Jackie, on this show, we would love to give you a chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
I am, guys.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Jackie, question number one, what is your favorite blog, podcast, or book of all time?
Well, this was a tough one. I'm a big podcast listener, so I just want to give kudos to those podcast content producers. But I'm going to say my favorite is a book called The Memo, The 5 Rules for Your Economic Liberation. It's written by John Hope Bryant, who is a giant in the financial literacy space, with a focus on serving underserved communities, underserved populations, and really bringing them this message of financial literacy. I just love all the stuff that he's doing. He's amazing. And the book, I just couldn't put it down.
Wow. That sounds like a book club book. We got to check in that. Thank you. All right. Question number two, an inflection point in your life that was especially memorable or meaningful.
You know, the thing that I go back to a lot, and I've taken this journey again with my daughter as well. After college, I was lucky enough to get a job, but it was 900 miles away. My very first job was at Walmart in Bentonville, Arkansas, at the home office. So I had to drive 900 miles by myself. I didn't really have that type of support where anyone was going to go with me, but I had to take this job. And I just remember my brother helped me. Walmart will give you this yellow Ryder truck that you can use to move your stuff. And that's just what they've been doing for years. My brother helped me hook my car on the back and he guided me out of the driveway. But I remember that day it was raining because I started tearing up because I'd never driven a truck this big and I was moving away from everything that I knew. But as I was driving, I just knew in my heart that this was going to change my world. And so I show up in Bentonville, Arkansas, and that was one of the first steps to moving into my own economic reality as a grown-up.
Jackie, I'm speechless. You talk in stories and I love it. And I think our audience is living this journey with you and excited for this next chapter that you're on and that we're on with you. It's very cool to be a part of this.
All right, Jackie, question number three, your favorite life hack.
My favorite life hack, I would probably give that award to my 529 plan. As I mentioned earlier, my daughter, you know, she ended up going to community college, which meant that I had a lot left over in my 529 plan. So I have stretched that out so far. It's ridiculous. I have shared a lot of the money in that account with 3 of my nieces that I knew was going to college because I myself was first generation college graduate. So I was so excited to see that I had nieces that were also trying to get through school. So I gave each of them $3,000 and I said, this is not going to pay for all of your schooling, but I want to let you know you're on the right track and to keep going, like make it to the finish line. And then I still have money left in that account because it's grown so much from when I started saving when my daughter was younger. I'm now going to be pursuing my master's degree and will be using part of the 529 money for myself. And I have dug into every little nuance that you could possibly use for a 529 plan. I mean, things like a computer, internet, even off-campus housing. So I now know how far 529s can go.
All right. Well, hang on here.
Oh, Jackie. The gift that keeps on giving. This is amazing.
So most people would question the point where you're leaving. You no longer need to work for money anymore. When you get to that point, your next choice is to go back and get your master's. I'm not judging, just curious. Tell us a little bit more about your thought process here.
Okay. Well, some of it kind of goes back to undergrad and how I never really got to enjoy the college experience or focus on my academics. This is sort of righting my wrong. This is reclaiming my academic prowess. But this time, I definitely wanted to focus on exactly what I wanted to learn about. So the program is a master's in personal financial planning and financial therapy. So it had to be perfectly aligned with what I want to do once I'm done with corporate America. So I'm so looking forward to it. I get to be a student full time now.
Oh my goodness. I have chills. This is so amazing. Thank you for sharing that with us. I love it. You get to, you know, dude, this is the right reason to go to school at this point. You're doing it from a wonderful financial place. It's incredible to see how this has come
free.
Amazing.
That's amazing. I mean, so many people also have questions about 529s. I suspect we could get you back on another segment to talk about 529s as well. I mean,
yes. And I want to mention this to you guys. So Sun Woo Lee, you guys know him, right? He's an admin. So I learned about the housing thing, the off-campus housing. I kept asking different people. And no, even CPAs didn't want to answer the question. I said, okay, I live in off-campus housing. It's just my home and I'm paying a mortgage. So does it matter? And finally, Sun Woo has an article where he says, if you live in off-campus housing, you don't necessarily need any receipts or anything like that. You just cannot go above the published cost of attendance for off-campus housing. So for me, I can use my 529 to pay my mortgage and all the other things that I mentioned. But his article was the only one that really addressed it head on. But I did all kinds of digging in the IRS code, and they don't specifically, they just don't dive into it. So in my opinion, when the IRS doesn't dive into something, I have autonomy, because unless you clearly state it or clearly spell it out, maybe it's not that important to you. So fine.
Well, we got more questions for you, and I'm so excited what we might get into. Question number four, the biggest financial mistake that you've made.
Gosh, guys, I made a lot of those, but I'm going to mention one that my daughter was so thrilled that I was willing to share this mistake, and it's actually in the book as well. When I was a struggling college kid, I decided to buy a new car. And I remember the exact amount of those payments. It was $326 a month. And back then in college, I was making minimum wage. And I think my annual income was barely $10,000. So it was crazy of me to even do this. So when I quickly realized that this $326 car payment was so out of my reach and I should not have done it. So I march off to the bank to see if I can refinance it to at least try to get my payments lower or something. So I go in there, I sit next to the person that was looking at my loan, and they looked at me and just said, you know, we cannot refinance your loan because you owe more on it than it's worth. And I felt so awful that day. I felt so low. I just went and slithered back into my $326 a month payment car and just cried. It was just so awful. Well, I will never buy a new car again, because since then I've learned a ton about how quickly cars depreciate and you should keep your cars longer. So many lessons in that. And my daughter just got a kick out of it that I made this huge mistake when I was her age.
Nice. Lessons learned. And I guess this really is a twofold question, right? Question number five, the advice you would give your younger self. And maybe really this is the advice you would give your daughter.
Yeah, that's true. Because the things that I wish I would have done different, I do kind of get a second chance on my daughter. I think the biggest one that I just cannot shake is undergraduate school and how I probably could have done it a lot different. I was really good academically. I probably could have focused more on my studies and academics and gotten a lot more scholarships to pay for my college versus just getting an hourly rate. So now I'm going back and kind of doing that by getting my master's degree. So I have something to prove to myself.
All right, Jackie, we have a bonus question. What is the purchase you've made in, let's say, the last year or so that has added the most value to your life?
Okay, so this is fun. For me, that would be the Ring doorbell. I love the idea that technology has gotten so great to where you can put this camera as many places outside of your house as you want, and you can see everything that's going on. When someone's at your front door, leaving a package, or even some shady character, you are catching them on camera. The big plus is I love the community around it because you get these alerts where if someone had a shady character at their house or if they saw someone steal a package, they can send that video to the entire Ring community that's in your area. So I think it also changes behavior of criminals because they're definitely going to think twice before they come to your house because they don't know who's got surveillance and, you know, who has surveillance and who doesn't. So I'm loving that behavior shift that the Ring doorbell has caused. And I'm glad that I'm a part of that community now.
The Ring doorbell. It's good for all of us if it grows in popularity. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. All right. People listening to this, I'm sure they are as inspired by your story as Brad and I are. They want to find out more. They want to connect with you. What is the best way for someone to do that?
Okay. They can head to my website, which is moneyletters2.com. But also, I'm very excited about an upcoming conference that I'll be speaking at. It's called Economy, and it's kind of a play on words. The last two letters is M-E. It's the Economy Conference, and it's on March 7th, 2020. And it's got this very cool lineup of provocative speakers all talking about financial independence, getting to your happiness through personal finance. And a lot of the other speakers that are on there are people that's been on your podcast, like Nurse Numbers, Julian from Rich and Regular, and there's several others. But the site for that is economyconference.com, and it's right in my backyard in Cincinnati. And so I would love to meet more of my FI community members at that conference. So you can find me there.
Nice. Brad, we got to do our best to get the word out. Economy in March, Cincinnati, Ohio. It's a one-day event. Jackie's going to be speaking there as well. As also, in addition to the people you mentioned, Doc G, I know he's going to be there as well, and several other familiar faces. So I hope that people that are interested in the area in just a local six-hour radius or beyond will definitely go check it out. And we'll have the links down in the show notes. Jackie. Wow. Thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a privilege.
Thanks, guys. It was awesome.
All right, my friends, if you got value from today's episode, and if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second and press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. Just lets the provider know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us and what we're doing here at Choose FI, here are four easy ways. One, leave us an iTunes review. To do that, just go to choosefi.com/iTunes. Two, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to choosefi.com/cards and get started today. Three, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in Cat. And four, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 100. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth one life hack at a time.